Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, and that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Pastor Douglas Vandermeulen, who's used to be here in the First Baptist Church of San Lorenzo Valley, and certainly we had a wonderful time when he was there. Now he's back in the garden spot of the north of Fargo, North Dakota. How are you, Doug?
Doing well. I'm trying to stay warm.
I bet you are. How cold is it there?
Well, it's about 12 below right now and a wind chill of about 27 below.
Well, I certainly don't envy you, but I appreciate so much you being willing to bundle up and come on here and of course, be with us this evening as we look at what's happening at the world from a political point of view, from a historical point of view, but mostly from a spiritual point of view, because, of course, that is your specialty. So what are your thoughts about what's going on today? And let me just start our program by mentioning to our leaders, to our listeners across America, that something big is afoot. I mean, I say that because, you know, I watch every day to see what's happening to precious metals. And this morning, surprisingly, gold, which had been hovering about $855 an ounce, was suddenly up to $885 an ounce. And, of course, it closed at $899 an ounce, actually an increase of about $44 an ounce. When you see a massive move in precious metals, something is afoot. Same thing happened as far as silver. Silver was up some 54, 55 cents an ounce, which is a major move for silver, up almost to $12 an ounce. It hasn't been to that level, well, going back almost a year now, certainly at least 10 months. When you see a major move in the precious metals, it means that there are uncertainties in the financial markets. We may not know what they are for a week or two, but something big is afoot. And, of course, what happens in the financial markets influences everything that's going on, not only in our society, in the world today, because the world economy is crumbling. And certainly, there are violent riots in Eastern Europe and Lithuania and Latvia. You're not hearing about it. There are lots of violent riots over in China. People are risking their lives because they're so, I mean, they're, think something like 18 million people out of work. And then, of course, that's just in the industrial part of the country. And in the farming industry, people have left the farms to go to the cities. And now there's no work on the farms. And of course, there's unrest in Greece. There's unrest in Ireland. Ireland is unrest in Iceland. The whole world is beginning to move, I believe, into a period of chaos and crisis. And I don't think it's happening by accident. I think it's happening by intent. But I think it foretells terrible times for the rest of the world. And I think as we see the unemployment here rising, and most people are just waiting for things to turn around, and I fear they're not going to turn around. I think they're going to go from bad to worse. And tell me what you think, Doug.
Well, we certainly are seeing, in my mind, some real economic confusion in Washington, and I've been kind of debating some of these things with some of my friends, and I'm just amazed at the number of people who are supportive of all these bailouts. And, the government is broke. You know, we have some $10 to $13 trillion deficit. A debt. We run a deficit every year, and now they've thrown somewhere between $1 to $3 trillion at this, trying to revive this economy, and you can't do that. No one can do that.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back here with Pastor Doug Vandermeulen. So you go right ahead. You were just saying that, of course, you can throw all the money you want to it at the economy, but you're not going to necessarily revive it. They've been, actually, last year, as of November, they've thrown over $7.4 trillion into this, and it hadn't done any good. Anybody wants to verify that, go up to our website, RadioLiberty.com. RadioLiberty.com and look at our November 2008 newsletter, and we've simply taken the figures from the Federal Reserve Board, and that is their figure, over $7 trillion they threw into the pot, and that has nothing to do with this new, of course, stimulus bill that President Obama is thinking of coming forward with, and certainly things are getting worse and worse and worse. So pick up the story, Doug.
Well, it doesn't take a PhD in economics to understand that you can't outspend your income. Now, they like to throw around that, you know, the debt is only a certain percentage of the gross national product and that sort of thing. But the reality is the only thing that's keeping our government afloat right now, our economy, I should say, is that they're printing what my dad used to like to call phony money. You know, they're sitting in the basement there at the mint, and they're cranking out money that they can't back. If you or I did that, that'd be called counterfeiting. The only reason why it's legal is because it's the government. But they don't have anything to back it any more than a counterfeiter does. And it's driving down the price of the value of the dollar. It's putting our whole economy at risk. And the real shame of it all is it's all unconstitutional. I believe we're witnessing the dismantling of the republic. We've nationalized our banks now. We're nationalizing our auto industry. We're nationalizing, or President Obama wants to nationalize health care. We've nationalized the mortgage with Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. You know, it would seem to me that in the next 4 years that we will at best be nothing more than a Western European socialist nation, and at worst, I think that our economy is going to totally crash in a way that will make the Great Depression of the 30s look like a picnic. I think that we are setting ourselves up for the true, genuine collapse of our entire system.
Will you hold that thought for just a moment? We'll bring our stations back on board. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, Pastor Vandermiller was just saying that really, of course, what we're seeing is the effort to nationalize our banks, to nationalize our automobile industry, to nationalize the health industry, to nationalize, you know, many of our businesses, which are, of course, having to take out loans from the government, and certainly we are moving towards a socialist economy, and a socialist economy doesn't work. This is the reason, of course, communism didn't work and eventually collapsed, and, of course, the only reason, of course, the system works at all in communist China is because they've had an element of free enterprise over there. The government is totalitarian, but their economic system was based upon the free market economy. But even that is collapsing today under this tremendous weight of the whole world economy collapsing. And, of course, Doug is pointing out that certainly we are printing. The only reason we're surviving so far is because they're just printing massive amounts of money. But that massive amounts of money is going to lead to an inflationary spiral that will destroy the value of the currency. And there's no better way to destroy a nation than to debauch the currency. And I agree with everything you said, Doug. And certainly, I think we're heading into terrible times. I think everybody is filled with hope and just, we hope things are going to get better. But, of course, I don't see that anything that is in the offing is going to change the downward spiral economically of this country. Do you?
No, I don't think so. I think that under George Bush, we had the largest infusion of money into the education system through No Child Left Behind. We had the largest infusion of money up until now through the Medicare supplement system that he established. And you've seen also a huge increase in entitlement spending. George Bush, and there's some who can say good things about him on certain things. Some who will say nothing good about him. But whatever whatever his legacy will be, and whatever kind of presence he was, at the end of the day, he was no economic conservative. And he has set up, in a lot of ways, the disaster we're in, as far as I'm concerned, he and the Republicans. The Democrats obviously share in some of that. But now we've got a new president who is, in everything that I've read about Obama and the people who have been the greatest influences in his life, says to me that he is, I don't mean this in any pejorative, you know, way, I'm just simply saying what I think I'm seeing, is he's a certifiable Marxist. I don't think he's a socialist. I don't think he's a liberal. I think he's a Marxist. That's the way, from the people that he was mentored under, to the people he's established himself with, the things that I hear him say. The guy is not some, Teddy Kennedy's a liberal, right? Obama's somewhere beyond that. We don't have a loyal opposition party in Washington that wants to stand up and fight against it. The Republicans are all out there breaking their arms, patting themselves on the back as they praise Obama as this great new president. So I don't know where this is going, but it's nowhere good.
Well, I think that you really hit the nail right on the head, Doug. Basically, if you study Obama's background, why he has worked with people who are dedicated Marxists, whether it be Saul Alinsky or certainly Bernadine Dorn, who was a communist revolutionary, or William Ayers, who was a communist revolutionary. So many of the people, there's a fellow over in Franklin Marshall over in Hawaii, communist revolutionaries. But what people really don't understand is that there has been a conscious effort to confuse the American people for many years. And it is one of the greatest scams of all time. And certainly it was after the Second World War when, of course, the American State Department turned Eastern Europe over to the communists and financed the communist regime there that crushed the people and took so many of the men off to work in the concentration camps to die in the Soviet Union. These were Eastern Europeans, just civilians. They just rounded them up and sent them off to the gulag to die. And then, of course, after the State Department turned Eastern Europe over to the communists, why then, of course, they turned China over to the communist regime by withholding support for the nationalist Chinese. And so there were a lot of people in America who said, look at what they're doing. There's got to be communists working in the State Department. That's the only logical explanation. The communists have got to be there. And that was the background behind McCarthyism. And what McCarthy kept talking about was the communist influence in Washington, D.C. And there really was a communist influence there. And this has been brought out in the Verona files. But the difficulty of all of this is it was never the communists who really determined our policy. It was the people in what we call the Anglo-American establishment, the Council on Foreign Relations. These were the ones who turned Eastern Europe over to the communists. These were the ones who actually turned China over to the communists. And now, of course, 50 years later, why, of course, we have the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations still here. But these are the people who elected Barack Obama. It's great to point to the communists, but Barack Obama has put their position into all key positions in our government. You'll find that literally every key position in the Obama regime has been given to a member of the Trilateral Commission, these wealthy intellectuals, or to a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. And almost none of these appointments are given to people from the radical left. A few of them are, but most of them are part of the American, Anglo-American establishment dedicated to world government and the establishment of a Marxist regime under a ruling intellectual elite right here in the United States.
Well, I think that, a lot of people thought that, and I think wrongly, thought that when the Soviet Union collapsed, that the whole issue of communism was over, the threat of communism was over, as if the fall of the Soviet Union meant that all communists were going, okay, capitalism was right, we were wrong. You know, the communists didn't go anywhere. I believe that I believe that those who were driving the agenda in terms of the Marxist-Communist manifesto are the same people who are leading the global warming scam, who are the same ones who are driving this alternative energy scam, who are behind the Kyoto Treaty scam. And all of that is meant to destroy the American economy. You know, out here in North Dakota, they have these wind farms. You can drive by and you can see these, you know, they have hundreds and hundreds of these windmills. Looks a lot like the Aldermot Pass there in California. And, you know, I always, and they were paying farmers thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars to turn their land over to these wind farms, which drives up the price of farming and produces not enough energy to make a difference. If you could get 10% of our energy from wind today, in 5 years it would be irrelevant, because our need, a growing economy, needs an ever-increasing energy base. The average, the use per capita, individual person in America, per capita, our energy use in the last 30 years has remained the same or actually gone down per person. But the amount of energy we use on any given day has, you know, gone up a hundredfold. And for our economy to be strong, we have to have nuclear energy. We have to have fossil fuels. We have to have the type of energy that you can have immediate increases. And wind can't do that. But my point is, the same forces that were trying to destroy America via communism are still doing it via Al Gore, via the whole alternative energy global warming stuff. And Americans are rolling over and accepting this stuff. I was out in San Diego last weekend, and I was talking to my brother, and I said, do you know anybody who believes in global warming? He said, no. I said, well, then why is it that it keeps getting, you know, our government keeps passing more and more stuff? I can't document this. I needed to save the thing I found this on. I had a source that showed that the average American last year spent $3,500 more in hidden fees for global warming legislation that's already been passed. And I believe this is all part of a scam to destroy the American economy, to destroy the country.
And I think that is the very essence of it, Doug. I think you're absolutely right. You say, why would any rational person want to destroy the American economy? And the answer should be self-evident. These are not rational people. These are people who have a different agenda, because I believe they worship a different God. But whether they, a lot of these people really, of course, are just not very smart. They honestly believe all of this propaganda put out by Al Gore. But in the final analysis, there is no way we can have an industrialized society with restriction as far as energy. They won't let us build nuclear power plants. They won't let us develop our oil resources. They put a man in charge of the energy department who hates coal. Obama has said he's going to raise the price of electricity. Certainly they want to restrict emissions from our cars and from our trucks. And they're making demands that they cut back dramatically. What they really want to do is get us out of our cars, to stop the production of electricity, and to destroy the industrial base of America. And that's why they're transferring our manufacturing to China and to Russia and to Brazil and Mexico. But they can't let the American people know they really want to impoverish our people. We'll be back in just a moment. And I think you're absolutely right, Doug, but I think that the average individual find it so difficult to believe that they really, the people in key positions in both political parties, really...
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a four-tape or a four-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer Iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets. A little protects your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Verkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Verkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
I know what it's like to lay awake at night and worry about mounting credit card debt. That nagging feeling in the pit of your stomach that just won't go away. And the phone calls from collectors. Forget about it. Then I called Help You Out of Debt. Their professional staff of debt mediators were able to help me get my upside down finances back on track and help stop the phone call. My Help You Out of Debt settlement specialist understood exactly what I was going through. My specialist was able to get creditors off my back, negotiate huge reductions on most of my balances, and help me fight back against the credit card companies. Help You Out of Debt specialists are experts in debt mediation and settlement. They are on your side. They've helped thousands of people just like me and can help you too. Call now and get a free debt review. If you're $10,000 or more in credit card or unsecured debt and ready to start fighting back, call 866-374-3101 and get your free debt review. That's 866-374-3101 or on the web at helpyououtofdebt.com.
Take a tour of the area. Why, he said that they noticed that in the parks, they had parks there for children, but all of the slides were broken, and the teeter-totters were broken, and the swings were broken. And he asked the girl, who was the daughter of the minister he was visiting, why they didn't repair, somebody didn't repair the teeter-totters and the swings and suddenly the slides in the park. And he said that they had a difficult time communicating because, of course, she, although she spoke English, the word and the concept of repair was something that was not in her vernacular. In other words, the idea of fixing something that was broken. So we picked the story up there, Doug.
Well, she, you know, when she finally realized what I was trying to ask, she just looked at me with this blank look and raised her shoulders. I don't know. And that I was actually staying with a young single guy named Alex, a wonderful Christian brother, and he had their apartment. His apartment was set up much like European apartments, where you've got your bathroom is a sink and an actual bathtub, and then you've got a toilet separate in what they might call a water closet. And so in his bathroom, there was this sink and this tub, and one faucet to do both of them, this real long arm that swung back and forth, and the thing is leaking like a sieve. Now, coming from California at the time, I'm looking at this water going down the drain, and I'm looking at this going, you just don't waste water this way. Water is like gold in California, right? And I said to Alex, how come you don't fix your faucet? He says, well, why? I said, because you're wasting water. He says, I don't care. I don't pay for it. And if I fix the faucet, he says, I will not live in this apartment forever, and then somebody else will get the new faucet. And I think that's what Reagan meant when he said communism is an evil disease. Here were these two, you know, 20, one was a 20-something, the other was a 30-year-old. They had no concept of stewardship, no concept of ownership, no concept of repair, no concept of making things nice. And I think our government has done a really good job of brainwashing our young people into not seeing communism as an evil disease, as a tyrant, as something that has destroyed life. I used to know a man named Dr. de Chalandot. He was a missionary, a Frenchman, who was a missionary into Russia behind the Iron Curtain. And he told me that he had personal knowledge of 40,000 pastors who had been put to death under the Soviet Union. 40,000 pastors, which is exactly what I learned when I was in Minsk. The pastor that I was there visiting said that when the communists took over, they rounded up all the real conservative doctrinal pastors and killed them, burned their libraries and killed the pastors, and then went to the more entertainment, you know, fluffy pastors and said, you can either die like the doctrinal guys or you can have the freedom to teach whatever you want, only we will sit in every service and make sure that you don't threaten the state. And these are the things that go on, and those are the same people who are trying to undermine America. And most people don't want to believe that because they want to believe that somehow America's going to last forever.
Well, I think what they really don't understand is there was a powerful force of organized evil behind communism. You cannot understand it unless you understand that certainly that Karl Marx was a Satanist who hated Christianity. And so was Lenin, and so was Stalin. And this was the common denominator that allowed, of course, the communist movement to work. This was a spiritual effort to destroy Christianity and to bring in, of course, a Luciferian way of life. Totally destructive. But those same identical forces are working here in the United States. And that is why they've taken God out of our schools, and prayer out of our schools, and the Ten Commandments out of our schools. And who did that? Why, it was the Masons who were in the Supreme Court, who controlled the United States Supreme Court, in majorities of 5-4 to 8-1. From 1941 to 1971, and if you doubt that, just go up on the internet and Google in United States Supreme Court Masons, and you'll come to pull up the websites, and you can see how the Masons controlled our Supreme Court. Why is that significant? Because Masons worship a different God. They don't worship the God of the Bible, although they may have a Bible there, but if you're in a Muslim country, they have, the Muslim holy book. If you're certainly in an Indian country, they have the Indian holy books. The Buddhist country, they'll have the Buddhist holy books. They worship the universal God. the great architect of the universe. And when you have people in secret societies sitting on the Supreme Court and working at the highest levels of our government, and they're so powerful that they can suppress the truth about what's going on, you realize that we as a nation are in very real trouble today. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest today is Doug Van Der Ulen, who I really miss. He was our minister when he was here in this community, and I want you to know, Doug, that you are severely missed. Now, you said you had several stories you wanted to tell. Was there another one?
Well, the one was about the water and the young lady who couldn't understand repair. I'd like to shift just a little bit, you know. A lot of what's going on, you know, we can point fingers at a lot of places, but we have to point the finger back at the church as well. The church, especially in America, there's certain places in the world where the church is really strong. Right now, Africa, Southeast Asia. But in the American church, I think has sold itself out. Obviously, I'm painting a very broad brush. There's good pastors out there. There's good churches out there who are faithfully preaching the gospel and preaching righteousness and standing up against evil. But when I was there in Santa Cruz, the head of the Pregnancy Resource Center told me that our church was the only church that would allow him to speak about against abortion, that the other churches wouldn't let him do that because they were afraid, because abortion was too controversial. You know, the churches don't teach doctrine. Churches don't do church discipline. There was a man who pastored there in Santa Cruz that I knew in a very conservative church, allegedly conservative, for 30 years, who told me personally that he never even used the word sin.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. No, you've got 1 more minute. Go right ahead. The minister said he never used the word sin?
From the pulpit, yeah. Wouldn't preach against sin. And, you know, you talk about there being this evil conspiracy. Well, why would anybody in America believe there's an evil conspiracy when the pastors won't preach against sin and immorality and abortion and homosexuality? You got Rick Warren down there at Saddleback who's come out supportive of same-sex marriages. The most popular man who sold the biggest-selling Christian book last year out there endorsing immorality. I mean, of course our people don't believe that there's evil. Of course our people don't believe that there's people who might actually want to destroy something. Because our churches won't stand up. We got kids who grow up who never are told anything.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and then Pastor Doug was simply talking about how he thinks that probably one of the major problems, and I certainly agree with him, is the fact that the church is not taking a stand against evil. The church is not teaching that we are all sinners saved by grace. They're not teaching the fear of God. There are many ministers who will not allow somebody to come into their church and preach against abortion, because, after all, that's a controversial subject, and a lot of Christians have had abortions, and you might make them feel uncomfortable. And so Doug's point is, and I think it's a very well-taken point, that we have a real problem in America, because the church is certainly not calling people to repentance and not speaking out against the true moral breakdown in our society. And, of course, there's no instance in all history where a nation has gone into moral breakdown where that nation has survived. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. If you have a question for Doug, why, we'd be glad to hear from you. Doug, do you have a website or anything you'd like to get out there? Do you have a radio program or anything up there in Fargo?
No, I don't have a radio program. I sure do miss those days, you know, on Radio Liberty. That was a real highlight in my life, and But our church webpage is www.cbcfargo.com. That's CBC Community Baptist Church Fargo, cbcfargo.com. And there's a link on there to my personal blog, and I post things periodically and posted even something today about from Al Mohler about how to pray for President Obama. And people are always free to check that out, and they can email me if they have questions. And but we're real excited about some of the things that are happening, but I still would go back and say the church has to be the church, and preachers have to preach the whole counsel of God. They got to get away from entertainment. They got to get away from trying to be seeker sensitive, and they need to preach against wickedness, the devil, the world, and sin. And until they do, things aren't going to change.
Well, I certainly don't see anything at the present time that makes me think it's going to happen. But I agree. I think the only real hope for America would be a massive revival in this country turning back to God, just exactly as happened in Nineveh when, of course, Jonah went there. And, of course, Jonah told them what was going to happen. And they believed him. And they put on their sackcloth and they fasted and they rent their clothing. And they turned back to God for a time. 60 years later, of course, they went back to their old ways, and God destroyed Nineveh and Assyria, and then another great nation took its place.
Well, see, the beauty of the church, though, is the gospel is the power of God unto salvation, and that's something that no one else has. Douglas Hyde, in his former communist from England, in his book Dedication to Leadership chastised the church. He says, as a communist leader, I could get people to give up six-figure incomes to live at minimum wage and still have money to give back to the party, and I was doing that based upon lies and falsehood. And he says, why is it in the church, where you have the truth and the power of God, you can't even get people to make a commitment to church membership, much less self-sacrifice? And he chastised the church, and I think rightfully so. But the beauty of it is we have the power of God in the gospel. And the churches don't preach the gospel of justification by faith alone, by Christ alone, received by faith alone. We preach moralism. We preach Jesus as some type of guru who can make your life better, 10 principles for successful living. We've turned the gospel into a therapeutic Gnosticism so that you can have your best life now, big book out there right now by Joel Osteen. And it's all a lie. It's all falsehood. And someone said to me not too long ago, said, Doug, you know, the only heretic left in America today is the person who still believes there's heretics.
I think that's very well put. And I agree with you totally, Doug, and I do miss you. Let's go to Mike, who's calling from Santa Cruz. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 if you'd like to talk to Doug, if you have a thought on this. But I certainly, Doug's point is that one reason, or probably the primary reason, we are having the problems we are is because the church is not doing what it should. And at one time, the ministers did preach the gospel, and they did, put the fear of God into people's hearts and realize, of course, God is certainly not somebody who's just going to give us whatever we want to. He's just not a buddy. He is the Lord Almighty, the creator of heaven and earth, unparalleled. There's nothing quite like him. This is the force that is actually able to direct the course of the wind and the storms, and of course we should be totally subservient to him. We should give our lives to him and let him direct the course of our lives, because when we direct the course of our lives on our own, we usually make an awful mess out of it. Well, let's go to Mike, and again, if you're out there and you have a question, number 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Mike, do you have a question for our guest?
Question and comment. Back when you were talking about Obama and Marxism, I had to ask myself a question. And I asked myself, what was the message of Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels? Hope. Hope in the state.
Okay, I think good point. And, of course, this is what we're told. We have to have the audacity of hope. We have to. But, of course, he believes that the state should do everything for us. And, of course, the constitutional concept is limit the power of the state so people could be free because they can do things for themselves. And almost every problem we have facing us today is a direct product of government intervention. The reason healthcare prices are out of bounds is because of government intervention. The reason that we're having the problem with the collapse of our economy is because they replaced, of course, our gold-backed currency with fiat money currency and created an artificial prosperity. But you go ahead, Mike. Did you have
a
question?
Have you heard any numbers on the percentage of the Christian vote that went to Obama?
I really don't know. Do you know anything about that, Doug?
Well, I remember seeing something. I actually believe, and I can't give you any specific numbers, but I just read something this week that said the majority of young evangelicals voted for Obama.
Yeah, that makes sense.
All right, fine. Anything else you want to say?
Doug was talking about the problems with the pulpit and not preaching sin, not even mentioning the word sin. Well, that's pretty strange because you can't preach the gospel, you can't preach the Bible. If you don't preach sin, you can't preach the crucifixion.
No, of course.
If you can't preach the crucifixion, you can't preach the resurrection.
All right.
If you can't preach the resurrection, you can't preach the lordship of Christ and the deity of Christ.
All right.
It's all gone.
How would you respond to that, Doug?
Well, I would agree, but I would disagree. I agree 100%, but I'm going to put it differently. The people out there who are preaching what I would say is a false gospel, which Mike is saying isn't the gospel at all, and that's where I agree with him. What they've done is, they've taken the law, which was meant to show us our sin. Paul explicitly says in Romans that it's through the law that we come to know sin. And the church has turned the law of God, which is to show me my sin, and have turned it into self-help principles. Very big name, national, internationally known pastor, won't mention his name. You can look the book up yourself if you want to find it. You can Google it. Wrote a book on the Beatitudes called The Be Happy Attitudes. Well, if you read that, Beatitudes, the whole point of the Beatitudes is the same point that the law is to show you your sinfulness. So we've taken the law of God and we've gutted it for its sin-condemning power and have turned it into basically self-help. Well, if the bad news of the law is no longer bad news, then I no longer need the good news of Jesus Christ. And so the gospel gets neutered and in such a way that now all Jesus is a God who loves me. There's no fear. There's no judgment. There's no wrath. There's no personal accountability. So if the bad news isn't bad news, the good news can't be good news. And that's where Mike is right. You can't preach the gospel if you're not preaching this other stuff. And so I'm not really disagreeing with them, but where I'm kind of disagreeing is that people out there all over the place think they are preaching the gospel. But they're not, because they've ruined the law, therefore they've ruined the gospel.
I think you're absolutely right. I agree with both of you. That was not for being a diplomat.
Yeah.
God bless you. Thanks so much, Mike. And let's go to Ruby, who's calling from Live Oak. Hi, Ruby. How are you doing?
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. I am very interested in the show tonight, as I am every night. I just want to say a few encouraging things.
All right, fine.
I've been to churches in the past who absolutely turned my stomach, churches that just, you know, Joel Osteen is all over the place and all of this, you know, purpose-driven popularity, actually. And it's really nauseating. But I've lived up here in Santa Cruz for about 6 months now, and since I've been here, I started attending a church right here in Santa Cruz, and it's definitely a very fundamental, conservative, Bible-believing church. And as a matter of fact, the people who run the Pregnancy Resource Center attend our church, and tomorrow All of us, or not all of us, but I'm going up to San Francisco for the Walk for Life, and a whole bunch of people from the church are going up there, and there are still conservative, Bible-believing people, even in Santa Cruz, and I know that my pastor is one of them, and I'm very, very happy that the Lord has led me to that church, so don't count us all out, because we're still here.
Oh, I would listen. There are a lot of, Doug specified what he said. He said, you know, there are good ministers out there, there are good churches. It's just that he's speaking of the vast majority, that certainly they're not doing what they should, and they're good people. I believe that they love the Lord, but they've been taught in their seminaries and certainly their meetings and their publications, to try to be popular rather than to be more pragmatic rather than be absolutist. And well, I don't think that you can equivocate on what the scriptures say. Ruby, is there anything else you want to say? Otherwise, I'm going to put you onto the hold, and I'm going to have you have our tell our producer what church you're going to.
Thank you very much. And good night.
Thank you so much. I mean, hang on, though. I want you to go tell our producer what church you go to. Okay.
Okay,
fine, and I'll ask our producer to pick up the line there if you're out there in the listening audience. And our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. And I have no question there are lots of good ministers out there, but it's not simply the majority of them. This is the major problem.
And, you know, in most denominations, and this is the pressure that most pastors are under, it's so hard to quantify the spiritual life, and this is why there's so much emphasis on trying to get people to make decisions for Jesus, because that's about the only way anybody can quantify anything. Did anybody come to Jesus this year? Well, you know, I had a friend who was doing the New Believers class at a very large church there in Santa Cruz, which you can narrow down to two churches. Anyway, they had 500 people make decisions at a Christmas program, and six people showed up to the new members class. But my point is, pastors, because you really can't quantify a transformed heart, a transformed life, you can't graph it, you can't put it on a PowerPoint presentation, so the denominations and the boards put pressure on saying, okay, the one thing that we can quantify is the number of people and the number of dollars. And if I want to keep my job, I got to get more people in the door, and the offering has to go up. Well, your offering probably isn't going to go up, and the people aren't going to come in unless you do the types of things that will draw spiritually disinterested, hard-hearted people. That's why, though there are some very noted large church exceptions to this, most of your churches where pastors are really doing the job the way God would have them do are in smaller churches, struggling churches. A lot of pastors that I know who are really A1, top-notch pastors have to be bivocational because there's not enough people in the church to pay them. I know of a pastor here in my area who's pastoring three churches at the same time, the largest of which is only 15 people. But the big churches are full because they got the rock bands, they got the Starbucks, they got the In-N-Out burgers for their youth events, they've got all the whistles and bells, but there's no doctrine, there's no teaching that could be controversial because they got to keep the people coming in and the offering going up. And that's one of the real danes of the American church, is the love of money. Bodies, buildings, and bucks becomes the standard by which we measure the gospel. And it ends up turning our face away from the Lord Jesus Christ.
Well, Doug, the only good thing I can say is that I think things are going to get terribly bad. And I think when times are bad, why people are going to begin looking for answers, and of course they're going to be looking for solace, and hopefully at that time, of course, they'll listen to the message of salvation with a different attitude, and they'll begin to understand that, you know, certainly they may lose very well everything that they think is giving them security when you destroy their pension funds, their life savings. Where do you turn? Where do you find any hope? And you find it in the gospel.
Well, that's right. And there was a couple old Puritan evangelists who were going to share the gospel in this one particular town in England. And some of their friends tried to stop them. Why would you want to go to that town? That town is known for its iniquity and darkness and hatred of the of truth. And the two evangelists said, "Ah, but the light always shines the brightest in the darkest places." And so the gospel is the power of God. And as things get worse, the truth will shine brighter. And those who are faithful to the Lord Jesus Christ, proclaim the truth. It may very well be that the best thing that will ever happen to the church in America is it actually happening as we watch the crumbling of our republic for the very thing you just said, Dr. Stan. That's where people will be crushed, and then will need to turn to look to find something greater than their iPod and their Mercedes and their surfboard and their 401k, and they're going to need to turn to the Lord Jesus Christ.
You're absolutely right. And of course, you know, I practiced medicine for many, many years in my town, and most doctors are not Christians. There were a few that were. Very, very few. And then, of course, some doctor would lose his wife or would lose his son, or there'd be a catastrophe in his life, and then he would turn to the Lord. And I saw that time and time again. The only thing that changed the people was, of course, that catastrophe. Well, Doug, we've got 3 minutes now, and I'm going to let you wrap up the program. And it's been a fascinating hour. I've really enjoyed having you with us.
Well, this has been a real honor for me.
I know what it's like to lay awake at night and worry about mounting credit card debt, that nagging feeling in the pit of your stomach that just won't go away, and the phone calls from collectors. Forget about it. Then I called Help You Out of Debt. Their professional staff of debt mediators were able to help me get my upside-down finances back on track and help stop the phone call. My Help You Out of Debt settlement specialist understood exactly what I was going through. My specialist was able to get creditors off my back, negotiate huge reductions on most of my balances, and help me fight back against the credit card companies. Help You Out of Debt specialists are experts in debt mediation and settlement. They are on your side. They've helped thousands of people just like me and can help you too. Call now and get a free debt review. If you're $10,000 or more in credit card or unsecured debt and ready to start fighting back, call 866-374-3101 and get your free debt review. That's 866-374-3101 or on the web at helpyououtofdebt.com. 866-374-3101.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Verkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Verkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
the Hood of Darkness or Here at I Talk on the Forbidden Secret. You need to get that information, and to get the Forbidden Secret, you really need to get the syllabus that goes with it, because you want to be able to read the things we're talking about and understand how so much of what's going on fits into the master plan, and there really is a master plan out there. And then, of course, let me just mention, we are carrying a series of DVDs that are put together by a young minister who, of course, has put his sermons onto the DVDs. And, of course, we have the final countdown. And, of course, it's based on the prophecies, the scriptures, telling about what is going to be happening in the future, 2,000 years ahead. Well, of course, this is what the scriptures were telling, what's going to happen 2,000 years from now, when we get to a point where you're not going to be able to buy or sell unless you have some sort of a mark and everything is going to be numbered. And really, how could that ever happen 2,000 years ago? And yet, we have that capacity today. And you'll certainly, I think, really enjoy the final countdown, the videos, the scriptures are there. And as he reads them, you can read them and check them out. And then he's done a great job of amassing information. The final countdown, we recommend to you. It's in two 5 DVD sets, part one, part two. Then we have DVD sets on creation. We have a four DVD set on RFID marking. And of course, most people don't understand that every farm animal by federal law now has to be registered with the government. And if you move a goose from the front of your house to the back of your house, you're supposed to report that to the government. Of course, what would they do with the information? Nobody ever asked. But every chicken, every fowl, every goat, every sheep, they're all to be registered with the government today and numbered. And with sometimes RFID and identification, they want to do that with every item on the store shelves, and they want to do that with every individual. Why would anybody in their right mind want to accumulate all of that data? Well, very simply, because it says so in the scriptures. You'll be fascinated by the material that Pastor Crone has. So the final countdown, two parts, creation, two parts, and RFID chips, one part. We also have a four-tape set on the spy chips put together. Some of it's the work of Dr. Catherine Albrecht. She's a personal friend of ours. And then, of course, we have her book, Spy Chips. You want to get this information. It goes right along with our talk on the planned police state and the syllabus that goes with that. And all of these items, whether it be my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, our talk on the forbidden knowledge for the syllabus, our talk on the planned police state and the syllabus, and of course that goes into the spiritual forces that are working behind the scenes. And then of course the material put out by Pastor Crone, the final countdown, creation, RFID, RFID identification, and of course the four tape set or four CD set on spy chips, and of course then the book on spy chips. You need to begin to correlate what's going on, certainly with scripturally, with what's taking place in the world in which we live today. Now our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927 or 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Our webpage is radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Let me point out that we really are dependent upon those of you who listen to our programs to help us. And if you're in a position to join the Radio Liberty family, we'd love to hear from you. And then, of course, we hope that many of you out there are making preparations for the very difficult times that lie ahead. If you'd like information on long-term food storage, on the Berkey water filters so that you can have potable drinking water, on the health products, and we're going to be carrying something called Garden in a Can. Garden in a Can, certainly seeds for long-term storage, and then please pray for America and Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of William Grigg. William Grigg, former senior editor of the New American Magazine, and now working, of course, with the Welch Foundation here, and, of course, writing blogs, and, of course, writing essays, and writing books, and, of course, appearing on radio stations, and, of course, one of them is Radio Liberty, and we have him usually twice a week, and we usually try to have him at this time at the end of the week, so he can keep us abreast of what's really going on and his views. William, what are we going to be talking about this evening?
Dr. Stan, thanks for having me again as a guest. It's always a blessing to be with you. We've been talking for a long time about the fact that what we're dealing with here in terms of this new administration under Barack Obama is not so much change as stasis accompanied with a new figurehead. And there was a really potent illustration of that yesterday when there was a big meeting at the State Department to install Hillary Clinton as the Secretary of State and to introduce the two new envoys for the Middle East. You had Senator Mitchell, former Senator George Mitchell of Maine, who is going to be the envoy to Israel and Palestine. And then, yeah, Richard Holbrooke appointed to be the envoy for Afghanistan. And, of course, as I looked at that, I was struck by a couple of thoughts, the first of which is that we're seeing a full-blown, undisguised Clintonian restoration here in terms of everybody below the level of the actual president. You're dealing with basically the third term for Bill and Hillary Clinton. And the second thing that struck me as I watched this, and I happened to see this on Fox News live while it was happening. I very rarely watch television. I don't have time for that most of the time, but I consider this to be sufficiently important that I sat down and watched it, was in looking at the body language, the people who gathered on the dais there at Foggy Bottom, and looking at the way that they were reacting to the various participants, it struck me how peripheral Obama was to everything that was going on here in terms of the way he comported himself and the way that he was dealt with. There were, of course, the de rigueur pleasantries that were uttered about the new president and his supposed vision and what an honor it was to be serving him and so forth and such like, but it seemed to me that there was a somewhat dismissive attitude that was being radiated by Vice President Biden, by Secretary of State Clinton, and by the other assembled luminaries here, because you're dealing with somebody who is very much a shallow, callow, inexperienced young man whose vita is paper thin, I guess it's thin to the point of translucency. And he's somebody who obviously is being squired around and given his marching orders and is very visibly under the control of the permanent oligarchical power elite that propelled him into the White House. And I think that very quickly there's going to be a sense of buyer's remorse on the part of the public that supported Obama on the assumption that he represented something new and fresh and distinctive in politics. I have to give credit, very guarded, qualified, and most likely revocable credit for the fact that yesterday Mr. Obama did sign a series of executive orders intended to rein in some of the most ghastly abuses that were perpetrated during the Bush administration with respect to the creation of an archipelago of secret interrogation sites and the use of torture as an interrogation method, and also an order that was signed very early after his installation as president to shut down Gitmo. But these are all things that are going to be working their way through the bureaucracy over the next year or so. There's still plenty of time for these orders to become attenuated. We have to remember as well that a lot of these policies have been embedded in what Washington is pleased to call law through legislative acts that cannot be repealed by a presidential signature. And we have to remember as well that the fact that one particular aspect of this network is being shut down doesn't mean that the others will not be open all the time as well.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. All right, go right ahead.
Yeah. This whole subterranean network of interrogation and secret rendition. And extraordinary rendition, by the way, was a practice that also began under the first Clinton administration. It was probably going on before then. The CIA has had proprietary airlines going all the way back to the period when it was the OSS, back in World War II and immediately afterward. And they were involved in all kinds of clandestine activities, drug smuggling and other things that were nefarious by way of building up secret and completely unaccountable bank accounts and other assets that they could drop on to work their magic in sowing insurrection and misery through the world. But with respect to interrogation and the use of black sites to hold detainees, what's likely to happen, I believe, is that rather than holding them at Diego Garcia or at any other of these secretive sites or ships in the open ocean in various places of the world, that they're going to be outsourcing this more and more frequently to third-party countries. Mr. Obama has not talked about shutting down the rendition program. The rendition program, as I pointed out, was not a Bush administration innovation. It was something that the Clinton administration started doing in the mid-1990s. And so I suspect what's going to happen is that you're going to see a cosmetic peeling away of the outer layer of the ghastliest measures that were imposed by executive fiat under the Bush administration. And this is going to have the effect of palliating the civil libertarians on the left, the self-described civil libertarians on the left, who were in high dudgeon and full-throated outrage during the Bush administration over these horrible things that were going on. But as of yesterday, the ACLU was running ads on the Internet claiming that they and Obama had shut down Gitmo and ended torture. That's premature by any means, but that's part of the game that's being played here. What they're doing is they're sending out little dog whistle signals to their pet constituencies to get them in line. That's what you do the first couple of weeks of any administration. Make sure that your base is in line by going out and doing a couple of highly symbolic, very potently totemic things that'll please them. These executive orders, of course, have pretty much now nullified the activist left, and so Mr. Obama, having laid the predicate here that he's a real reformer and somebody restoring the moral integrity of the United States, can go on now and do exactly the same things that George W. Bush did in terms of his foreign policy and domestic policy and illegal wiretapping and surveillance and such like and so on. Once you establish the reputation for being punctual, it doesn't matter how late you show up at the office, they consider this to be an exception. That's the sort of thing that's going on right now. And the left has been looking for that kind of sense of triumphant, vindictive success. And now they're going to revel in it for a while, but it really hasn't changed things materially yet. Although, once again, I have to give qualified credit to the fact that at least those orders now exist.
Hold that thought. Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. And Chris William is just commenting that suddenly orders had gone out from the executive branch of government, Mr. Obama, to end torture, to close Gitmo, to close down the CIA torture centers all across the world. And, of course, one other thing that appealed to me was certainly when George Bush went in, the first thing he did was say, well, we don't care what the law says as far as freedom of information is concerned. You know, we won't tell you that unless there's some specific reason why you should give information, you should not give information. You should withhold it because we don't believe in an open, translucent government. Now, Mr. Obama has said, well, you know, people, you know, if somebody wants information under the Freedom of Information Act, give it to them. You know, but of course, is it going to make a difference? We're just going to have to wait and see whether there really will be transparency. I will say one thing, William, and that is we got an awful lot of information released under the Clintons that we could never get out under either George Bush, Ronald Reagan,
That's true.
The second Bush administration. So let's hope for the best, but keep our guard up.
Well, what I suspect is going to happen, and I am once again at once very guardedly pleased with a couple of things that were done and immensely suspicious about what's going to happen as by way of follow-through here. What I suspect is going to happen is that Mr. Obama is going to do the same kind of thing that most administrations do. It's just that he's going to make a fetish out of it, and that is that he will provide perfect transparency regarding the transgressions of his predecessors. Everybody, of course, likes to find ways of diverting attention from his own transgressions by talking about what was done before him or what is being done by people who are supposedly more unabashed sinners, you know, people of a different order of magnitude of brazenness when they're committing sin. I think it was the Rochefoucauld who always said that we're eager, of course, to magnify the transgressions of others in order to conceal our own. In this case, you have Mr. Obama entering the White House after 8 years of the most concerted, brazen, unabashed assault on the rule of law, perhaps the history of the executive branch. That takes in a lot of territory if you consider people such as Clinton and Nixon and Lyndon Johnson. You'd have to consider, of course, FDR to be on that list, and Wilson and Lincoln, a number of other people have been just horrible in terms of considering themselves to be above the law by virtue of their office. But I will be impressed with Mr. Obama's commitment to transparency as soon as he allows the release of his records at Columbia University. I mean, that's something that a lot of people have been asking about. Why has he made a point of sealing up and refusing to disclose his college records? Most people's college records are available if you want to do a little bit of digging. I happen to know for a fact that Joe Biden, the vice president, his college transcripts and records are available because they were released over 20 years ago during the 1988 presidential campaign after he made the mistake of berating some random fellow at a state fair in Iowa and talking about how his, that is Biden's, IQ was much higher than that of this common citizen. Well, some enterprising reporter was able to go back to, I believe, Dartmouth, if I'm not mistaken, and get the college transcripts and found that Mr. Biden was a solid C student. So that's the sort of thing that perhaps explains why Mr. Obama doesn't want to release his college transcripts. I, of course, am not going to be boasting about my college transcripts, but the point is that there's a certain transparency here that many presidential candidates have been subject to that Obama tried to avoid. I believe that his medical records also have not been made public. And now, of course, he's talking about a culture of openness here with respect to Freedom of Information Act requests. I believe that that will probably apply much more readily to the acts of his immediate predecessor than anything he will do. And by way, once again, of illustrating the continuity between Bush and Obama, irrespective of the differences in style that you see here, I think it's interesting that one of the very first things that happened during the Bush administration, I believe 2 days into the first Bush administration, there was an airstrike ordered by Mr. Bush against targets in Iraq. And then 2 days into Mr. Obama's presidency, there's a Predator drone strike in Pakistan that killed as many as 30 people, including a couple of dozen children. And it just seems to me that there is this rite of passage that involves bloodying the president, that you're not truly a president until you have ordered somebody to be killed. That goes back to a principle you can read about in the last book of Shakespeare's drama of King Henry the Fourth, and then in the beginning of King Henry the Fifth. Everybody remembers that passage where Henry, talking to the then Prince Hal, who was going to succeed him to the throne of England, urging him to be at thy course to busy giddy minds in foreign quarrels, and the reason why that this would be done, according to the dying King Henry the Fourth, is because Prince Hal was a very young man, and he had a reputation of being a Bush-style party animal, disporting himself in very unseemly ways of Falstaff and other people of that ill repute. And so in order to assume the mantle of the kingship, in order to fill out the stature of a monarch, it was necessary that he go out and kill somebody in a hurry. And it just seems to me that there's this rite of passage now that occurs within the first week of the presidency, maybe the first couple of days, where on some pretext a president has to order a military strike somewhere in the world so as to get his hands bloody, so as to certify that he is actually a president. You're not a president until you've killed somebody. And Mr. Obama has made a point of saying during the campaign, and as a matter of fact, I think since his inauguration, that he considers Pakistan to be a rogue state that we will probably end up confronting militarily. And the prospects in that area of the world, if we find ourselves in that particular conflict, and that conflict has been going on. There have been airstrikes going on, there have been incursions, there have been special forces operations there on that border between Pakistan and Afghanistan. Of course, now they're going on. They could have been usefully going on in late 2001 at Tora Bora to stop bin Laden from fleeing, but now they're going on long after the horses fled the barn and been captured and butchered and served up on the table of a Frenchman. And what's going on right now is that there's all these precursor activities to some kind of a major military operation inside Pakistan, which is a huge country full of people who are very much in affinity with the Taliban and bin Laden's version of radical jihad. I believe that the threat of Al-Qaeda is almost entirely a confected one, but there is that strain of jihadist Islam that has been very diligently cultivated over these decades by our good friends the CIA, and that cultivation has borne evil fruit, and a lot of that fruit is blooming over there in Pakistan, and it's a nuclear-equipped Muslim state. And so you run the strategic options and scenarios out. If we end up in a military confrontation with Pakistan, they look pretty ugly indeed.
Let me just comment, certainly I share your concern about Pakistan, and especially because it is a nuclear-armed country. But
yeah.
What most Americans do not know is what's contained in my January 2008 newsletter, the story of Sybil Edmonds, who worked for the FBI, who uncovered a spy ring operating at the
yeah.
highest level of the American State Department that was actively smuggling nuclear technology to Pakistan. And Sybil Edmonds wanted to bring this out, but the FBI wasn't allowed to cover it, to reveal this. The State Department would not reveal it. The Justice Department put on the Secrecy Act so she couldn't bring it out. She went to the local federal court, to the appeals court, to the United States Supreme Court. This information could not be brought out, that the United States State Department was actively involved in allowing the transfer of nuclear technology to Pakistan, and eventually was brought out in the London Times in
yeah.
January of last year. And you'll find the story, certainly on my website, as well as the references for it. And the question is, why in heaven's name would logical people allow the transfer of American technology to Pakistan so it could be transferred then to North Korea and to Iran? Why would you want to arm a rogue state like Pakistan with nuclear weapons unless there's a long-range plan for something terrible? And so let me just suggest,
yeah.
going along with what William has said, to go to our website, look up our January 2008 newsletter, the story of Sybil Edmonds. You can read it on the internet, but we've done all the work for you. You can read it, the whole story there, the references. And the thought of a confrontation with another major nuclear power has frightening implications, because believe me, America is no longer an isolated state, and our cities are as susceptible as theirs are. Go right ahead, William.
That's a wonderful point. That's a very important element of the story. And you bring up, by introducing the subject of Sybil Edmonds and her disclosures and the efforts that have been taken to stifle her, a very important illustration of the sort of thing that would represent genuine change if Mr. Obama were actually in charge and if he were inclined towards substantive change in the way that Washington does business with respect to national security. I don't doubt that there are people in his immediate circle, and probably Mr. Obama himself, very well aware of what Sybil Edmonds has disclosed. It's the sort of thing, of course, that has been made known to relevant committees on Capitol Hill, in the Senate, and in the House of Representatives. There are many people in the national security structure who are aware of what she has done, and I don't doubt that there are many patriotic people who are very outraged over what's happened and are working with great urgency and diligence to try to get something done to grab hold of the people responsible for this and to hold them accountable and to make sure that Sybil Edmonds' disclosures are taken into account and that policy is made to correct to address the betrayal, the treason that she's describing. That being the case, if Mr. Obama were actually an agent of positive change, he'd do something about Sybil Edmonds. I mean, it's within the power of the president to extend to somebody like Sybil Edmonds the type of immunities that could make her, could give her the proper platform and opportunities to make her disclosures public. And it's within the power of the president in the use of the bully pulpit and also with his influence on Capitol Hill to call in political favors to get her before the correct committees and to get action being taken by Congress and also within the Justice Department to look into these disclosures and find those who are responsible for this huge threat to our national security. So far we've seen nothing in that realm. And that, I think, is perhaps the single biggest unaddressed scandal of the Bush administration. You'd think that somebody interested in going after the crimes of his predecessors will be interested in this one in particular.
Well, I think what's frightening is, of course, the implications of a nuclear holocaust, of course, involving not only the Middle East, but involving the United States as well. Ladies and gentlemen, we're not talking about something theoretical. Go to our website, radioliberty.com, January 2008. Well, William, you go right ahead.
Well, we've been talking about the Middle East and the Near East and some of the things that are happening in that crescent of crisis that encompasses the Persian Gulf, the region up through the subcontinent, India to Pakistan, Afghanistan. The thing that I find really interesting as well with respect to the Middle East and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in particular is that Mr. Obama has picked up without missing a step. The baton was handed off with perfect seamlessness from Bush to Obama with respect to what's going on in the struggle, this perpetual struggle between the Israelis and the Palestinians, particularly the just-concluded war, invasion, incursion, military action, however you want to characterize it, in Gaza involving Hamas, which is in large measure a creation of Israeli intelligence that was created as a foil for Fatah, the faction, the political equivalent of the PLO, back in the mid-1980s. And then, lo and behold, this radical Islamic resistance organization, I believe Hamas literally means Islamic resistance, found itself in the position where it became the elected government of Gaza. Now you've got Hamas running Gaza, and you have the Palestinian Authority under Mr. Abbas, who, by the way, is no longer the legal president of the Palestinian Authority, but still carrying out that office as if he were. They're in charge of the other Palestinian territories. Mr. Obama, during yesterday's press conference at the State Department, went out of his way to talk about the fact that his administration will be directing aid and monetary support, supposedly to relieve the suffering of the Gazans, through the Palestinian Authority, which is that same thoroughly corrupt, almost incomparably corrupt governing mechanism that Arafat had created, which has between 6 and 8 secret police forces. Most of them were trained by the Soviets back in the 1970s and 1980s. The people that were in charge of them are communist-trained terrorists of that vintage. They're, of course, in charge primarily of preserving the monetary and other benefits, assets of the ruling elite of the Palestinian Authority. There's a fascinating account that I read in a book by an author named Richard Ben Kramer. He goes over and lives in Israel half of each year, and he was actually given an audience with Arafat a couple of years before Arafat died. And he said that all Arafat did all day long, from the time he got up after he's finished with breakfast until the time he went to bed in the evening, was to write checks. That's all he did. All he did all day long was to make bribes, to take aid that he'd received from the United States and from the European Union, and parcel it out as was necessary in order to maintain his political position. He was basically a guy who was in charge of brokering bribes. And he had 6 secret police agencies that were in charge of carrying out this particular disbursement and also to guarantee that the funds that were earmarked for such and such a person got to such and such a person, and also, of course, to provide physical protection for Arafat and his cronies. That's all they did. They weren't involved in any way in looking to the interests of the Palestinian people. They were there primarily, they were exclusively, for the benefit of this incredibly corrupt ruling class. And the same thing's going on under Abbas right now. And just yesterday, Mr. Obama said that, once again, when the aid begins to flow in order to reconstruct what has been torn up and broken down and bombed out in the most recent military conflict, it's going to go by way of the Palestinians.
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess it's William Grigg, of course, and we're talking about what's going on over in the Palestinian area today, the fact that Mr. Abbas, who was so corrupt that the Palestinian people voted him out of office, but that didn't really matter.
No,
we didn't like Hamas, which created Hamas, but we favored the Palestinians, and so despite the fact that Mr. Abbas had been repudiated democratically, we still backed him, and of course targeted Hamas. So you've got 2 terrorist organizations, but we're backing the one that the people really don't like. They don't like it because the PLO was so corrupt under Arafat and, of course, just stole millions of dollars $1 billion that was supposed to go to the Palestinian people. I mean, you know, their unemployment rate's 50-60% over there. The people are living in abject poverty. And, of course, the money we give does not go to the people. It goes to keep the corrupt government in power, headed by Mr. Abbas, who was voted out of office, but we're still backing him. Go right ahead, Mike.
Yeah. And the thing is, once again, if we were talking about genuine change in the policy that defines our involvement in that part of the world, what we would talk about, I think, if we were really interested in doing something that not necessarily would solve the problem, look, there are some problems that are insoluble this side of eternity. I think the Middle Eastern conflict might be that type of a problem. I don't know. I'd hate to be that cynical. But examining it from the perspective of 40, 50, 60 years, the last 40, 50, or 60 years, let alone the last several hundred years, I'm not certain that there are minds acute enough to cut through that Gordian knot. But the thing that we could do that would stop making matters worse would be simply to withdraw all aid from everybody in the region, because the fact that we are in an unconstitutional fashion, which is, of course, the most important consideration in a public policy sense, in an unconstitutional fashion we're providing foreign military aid to Israel, to Egypt. Jordan, of course, is somebody who's on Washington's payroll. Practically every leader in the Arab world at one point or another has been on the CIA's payroll. The Palestinians are on the State Department's payroll. They're on the payroll of the Agency for International Development. They're on the CIA payroll. When I was in Chicago in 1997 attending a seminar for law enforcement on terrorism, I've mentioned this before, I believe, there was a presentation made by a lady by the name of Kathleen Kiernan from the ATF, and it started out with a photograph of her standing next to Arafat, and she was talking about the fact that the ATF was providing aid and training to some of the security agencies for Yasser Arafat. I almost fell off my chair. And when I asked her about that after the meeting, she wanted to know what agency I worked for, and I said, I don't work for an agency, I'm a journalist. And she was astonished there was a journalist in the room. She thought that was the sort of thing that really shouldn't get out to the public, so I made a point of publicizing it right away. But the point I'm making here is that we're involved up to our necks in every element of this conflict, and because we're involved in that conflict, we've created a really perverse incentive for the conflict to continue. If we were to withdraw our aid, I honestly believe that the fact that we would stop subsidizing the worst elements of this conflict would mean those elements would get flushed out of the system eventually, and that more reasonable, more malleable perhaps is the wrong word, more tractable elements would arise within all the various communities that are involved in this conflict, then eventually be able to find some way of working out a modus vivendi. But that's the last thing people want. They want that conflict to continue. And it continues with such stunning, predictable regularity. I mean, this most recent Israeli incursion into Gaza had nothing to do with protecting the Israelis from rocket attacks. First of all, the rockets we're talking about have the throw weight of a Roman candle. And I believe that the only purpose why they're being used is to provoke that kind of a reaction from the Israeli military. I honestly believe that there are elements within the supposed leadership of the Palestinians in Gaza who are trying to precipitate that type of a conflict from time to time. And this was carried out. This is something you can read about in great detail in the Israeli press. The Israeli press is wonderfully candid about these things. This military campaign was carried out for political motives. It was carried out by Olmert and company because they wanted to make the Labor Party look tough and hawkish going into an election. And so you have a situation where they're not making anything better for anybody on either side of this most freighted of dividing lines, and they're doing so for pure political, cynical political gain. So you end up with hundreds of people being killed. That, of course, means that in the due course of time, we're going to see thousands of suicide bombers emerge from among the extended families of those people who were killed. That, of course, will not make things better for the Israelis. It'll make things even worse for the Palestinians. And we're funding all of this. We're funding both sides of this conflict, and we really have to stop. But that's not the kind of change that Mr. Obama is talking about, of course.
I agree with you totally. Well, we're in a very, very difficult period. Mr. Obama, I fear this, is simply the front man for the people who put him in power. You find that 10 members of his key advisors come from the Trilateral Commission, and of course the Trilateral Commission only has about 120 members here in the North American chapter, but of course their goal was to take over the government of the United States. They do, and they give us a different president every 4 years, but it really doesn't matter. Well, we'll be right back just a moment here. Hang on. And go right ahead, William.
One of the things that I think we're going to see in the first year of the Obama administration, given the fact that it once again is the direct continuation of the Bush administration, irrespective of the way that it's marketing itself as a repudiation of the Bush administration, is that there's going to be a much greater emphasis on what's going on domestically than what's been going on overseas. I think that what's going to happen during the next 5 or 6 months is that there's going to be this perverse bidding war going on between the White House and the Republican minority in Congress. And I think that that's because the Obama administration wants to make sure that whatever comes out by way of a so-called stimulus package is going to have a bipartisan imprimatur on it. They want to make sure that both parties are in the game. Obama used a really interesting sports metaphor where he said everybody has to have some skin in the game. Everybody has to be invested. Everybody has to have some chips in the pot, if you will, to use a different gloss on that same cliche. And that's because you want to have the protection of bipartisanship when things go bad, and things will go bad. These people are intelligent enough to know that you cannot cure problems created by inflation through inflation. But what you can do, of course, is you can make things very, very much better, at least better in the short run, for people who are in government employ and those who are political friends of the government in the corporate world. And so what's happened is that over the last couple of days there have been some negotiations between the Obama administration and congressional Republican leadership, the minority leadership in Congress. And the Republicans are balking right now. And the reason why they're balking is not because they want to make the so-called stimulus package smaller. They had every opportunity to be telling the Bush administration 2, 3 months ago, 4 months ago, 5 months ago to be reining in its profligacy, and they didn't do so. No, what the Republicans want is they want to make sure that their constituencies are taken care of when the stimulus package is put together. And what the stimulus package, of course, is a whole herd, the Gadarene herd of hugely swinish pork, and it doesn't matter what it's spent on, they're going to spend as much as they can on everything they can imagine. I live right on the border between Idaho and Oregon. I'm literally 2 miles away from the Snake River, which provides the border for this part of these two states. And so I get newspapers from Oregon and get the news and pay attention to what's going on here, because really economically we're part of a community that spans the border between these two states. And the state of Oregon, like the state of Idaho, like every other state you can think of, is putting together a list of stimulus projects that they want the federal government to fund.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly William is talking about the stimulus programs. Idaho is putting together a stimulus program, Oregon putting together a stimulus program, and both states want the federal government to come up with funds to stimulate the economy in their state. Now, where is the federal government going to get the money? Certainly we're having to borrow several $1 billion every single day to pay our debts. Fortunately, in the past, other countries have been foolish enough to fund our debt. I mean, why would you want to fund the debt of an individual who would never be able to pay the money back? And this is the situation. America is so deeply involved in debt, there is no way she can ever pay off the current debts that we have. And one of these days, of course, the other countries of the world are just going to say no more. In fact, if you read the classic article that Paul Volcker wrote back in 2005, he said that sooner or later, you know, we're going to find the other countries are no longer going to fund our deficits, and at that point, why, the whole system is going to change. Well, Paul Volcker is really the man who's going to be in charge of the current, the Obama legislation administration from an economic point of view. And it may very well be that that point is almost here, because today The price of gold went up $44 an ounce. The price of silver went up 54 cents an ounce. So something big is afoot. It's going to be very interesting to find out in the next few days what is going on. But remember, we are a bankrupt nation. And when Oregon and Idaho go to the federal government for handouts, the question is, where is the money coming from? And they're already talking about a $1.2 trillion debt for the year 2009. And it could very well be, they're talking about a $1.2 trillion debt. It may very well be $2 trillion or even more. Go right ahead.
Well, I'd be surprised if it's not something more on the order of 4 or 5. And I'll tell you why. If you've been following, I know you follow Paul Krugman. He's very difficult to follow because those of us who try to conduct ourselves as creatures of reason have a histaminic reaction to people who are completely irrational, and Paul Krugman is one such person. He won the Nobel Prize for Economics, which means that he's a Marxist, and he, from his perch there in academia and at the New York Times, he is vaticinating constantly about the supposed virtue of untrammeled, unrestricted government spending, deficit spending. He's a Keynesian of such a unique purity that I honestly believe the Keynes would take issue with him. The Keynes would be a little bit less emphatic, a little more pragmatic, if you will, than Mr. Krugman is.
Well, I'm sure he probably would get right along with Robert Mugabe there.
Exactly. You know, you've got the government of, well, what passes for the government of Zimbabwe now, putting out a $100 trillion Zimbabwean banknote. And the reason why they're doing this, of course, is because they want to get out in front of the anticipated hyperinflationary curve, which is, you know, millions and millions of percent a year. And so the thing that I find interesting about Krugman's prescriptions for Obama's so-called recovery plan is that he is always urging Obama to do something much more extravagant, much bigger. And he thinks that the opening bid that Obama made, which was $775 billion in so-called stimulus spending, stimulus being a convenient term to justify any kind of spending for anything under the sun, he thinks that that is two-thirds too small. So he wants something that is, you know, once again, roughly three times that big. So you're talking about something on the order of, what, $3.3 trillion in spending. All of which, of course, would be deficit spending because we don't have that much money in taxation that we can bulk out of the productive parts of the economy. It would have to be funded by foreign sources, obviously, who are going to gag on that, I believe. I really believe that when we're talking about profligacy of that order of magnitude, people are not going to be buying our bonds. They're going to start dumping the bonds. Just yesterday, the International Herald Tribune had a headline that said the Treasury Department has now said basically to the Fed, okay, you need to start printing money. I'm paraphrasing badly that headline, but that was the gist of it. Where, you know, gentlemen, start your printing presses. And the thing is, the Fed has been printing funny money. I don't know because the statistics on the growth of the money stock are being very cagedly withheld from the public, but as of last fall, when the estimable Dr. Gary North did some forensic research into the relevant statistics, he discovered that they were inflating something on the order of 280% annualized on the basis of what happened between September and November of last year. And I believe that's just the beginning of sorrows here in terms of printing press money. But all these state governments are lining up with their wish lists. And that means that they're going out to all their constituencies, all the tax devouring constituencies in every state are getting into a line with their begging bowls out, demanding a cut of this so-called stimulus package. And all the federal bureaucracies are doing likewise. And what amazes me is that the very first use of this stimulus is going to go right into the hands of the people who are in the business of regimentation and extraction, that is to say, extraction of wealth from the productive and regimentation of the lives of the rest of us. Just one really good example that's one of my favorite bugbears. There's a program that the Justice Department has called the Byrne Grant, B-Y-R-N-E, grant program. I write about it in my most recent book, Liberty and Eclipse, rather. And The Byrne Grant Program is used to create multi-jurisdictional narcotics task forces, usually involving some combination of the DEA, the ATF, state and local police, and almost always a heavily paramilitary element, SWAT teams, tactical teams, and so forth. And they always involve the use of seed money in the sense that they go out and they buy up informants to go and arrange drug busts. And usually these drug busts are carried out with no regard for due process. And they often involve people who are not necessarily involved in either the consumption or the distribution of illegal narcotics. But you end up with the process of forfeiture playing a role. Civil asset forfeiture takes place when the police simply seize property or seize financial assets from somebody and say that the property or the financial assets were somehow implicated in drug trafficking. And so they will hold the property guilty of involvement in drug trafficking, whether or not charges are ever pressed against the people from whom those assets are seized. The Byrne Grant Program is very much tied in with forfeiture. And it's tied in with the militarization of the police. It's one of the major conduits that's been used over the last 5 or 6 years to militarize the police and to tear down whatever procedural rights and immunities people enjoy when they're on the receiving end of these paramilitary strikes. Well, that's going to receive a big boost in the stimulus budget, according to the news clippings that I got today from people who are specialized observers of this particular subject. But that's just one example of the sort of thing that's going to happen. You can just bet that the IRS is going to get a lot of money in the stimulus program. Basically, what the stimulus means is they're going to goose the budget. They're going to increase it by whatever order of magnitude is necessary in order to spend the money to pump it out in whatever quantity to get the economy going again, because they believe that the way that we become prosperous is through spending. It's not through productivity and thrift. It's not by the enhancement of commerce, by people actually building things that people want or providing legitimate services that people need. No, it's through spending. It's through the increase in aggregate demand by pumping more money into the economy and getting people to spend on whatever. The other thing that's going to happen, and I honestly believe they know that this is going to end badly. They have to know that this is going to end up with a situation where the dollar collapses and we end up going the way of Zimbabwe. And people, because they want to protect their assets, might be driven in many severe cases to leave the country to try to save whatever they've earned. I honestly believe, this is something that Peter Schiff has talked about as well, that before the end of the first term of the Obama administration, you're going to see export controls put on capital, and you're going to see very severe restrictions being put on the ability of people to leave the country with their assets. I mean, if you go back and look at the Communist Manifesto, or as Mr. Obama would refer to it, the Constitution. I mean, I think that's the Constitution he had in mind when he flubbed the oath a couple of days ago, was the Communist Manifesto. One of the planks of the Communist Manifesto talks about the confiscation of wealth from immigrants and rebels. In other words, the idea is that once the communists take over a country, everything that pertains to that population, all their wealth, all their property, their physical lives, all that becomes the collective property of society. And so if you try to leave, then you have to surrender all your wealth, because that wealth really belongs to the government in acting in the name of the collective. And I honestly believe that that's something that's going to be discussed, maybe not in terms quite that blunt, but I can certainly see where the logic of what Obamanomics would do to our actual economy would dictate severe impositions of that kind. And there was a straw in the wind on that front that was in Mother Jones Magazine today. Mother Jones Magazine is a left-wing publication. It's done some good investigative journalism on some of the civil liberties issues and also on the issues having to do with the CIA's role in fomenting radical Islam. It was a contributor to Mother Jones who wrote that book, The Devil's Bargain, for instance, which I know you carry, Dr. Stan. But they're still a left-wing publication, and every once in a while they end up displaying their political genetic legacy. And there was an article by a fellow by the name of David K. Johnson. Mr. Johnson writes for the New York Times. He's a professor of economics. He wrote a book that I read a couple of months ago called Free Lunch that was a really ambivalently good book, because it did talk about the various ways that wealthy wealthy people create political lobbies in order to redirect largesse their way through the tax system. That's, of course, something that's very replete in our system, rather, is very replete with that type of socialism for the wealthy. But Mr. Johnson himself is a socialist of the old school. He believes in economic redistribution. He just wants the government to be redistributing wealth to benefit different constituencies. So in this article in Mother Jones today, he's talking about the fact that there are people who have taken advantage of perfectly legal ways of protecting their money from tax liability in offshore accounts. Right now, of course, the IRS is working with tax police over in Europe to go after some of these tax havens in Luxembourg. And now what David K. Johnson and Mother Jones is talking about is the need to make a military introduce a military element into tax enforcement. This is what he wrote. In 1983, just 10% of America's corporate profits were funneled through places that charged little or no corporate income tax. Today, more than 25% of profits go through tax havens. The Obama administration could tell the Caymans, now fifth in the world in bank deposits, to repeal its bank secrecy laws or be invaded. Since the island nation's total armed forces consists of about 300 police officers, it shouldn't be hard for technicians and auditors, accompanied by a few Marines, to fly in and seize all the records. Bermuda, which relies on the Royal Navy for its military, could be next, and so on. Long before we get to Switzerland and Luxembourg, their governments should have gotten the message. I mean, this guy's literally talking about making it a matter of military policy to go out and beat down these countries who, for reasons of national preference, have created tax havens in their banking system. Why? Well, so that the federal government will be able to have access to the tax assets that have been squirreled away in the banks of the Caymans and elsewhere, because the government's going to have to be more proprietary about what we earn. And it's that basically is a military application of that plank of the Communist Manifesto. He's also talking here about how there's no reason we cannot pass laws to block financial transactions or tax havens, or even Cuba-style. Listen to this. Even Cuba-style, make it a crime for Americans to visit or do business with them without special permission. Congress could declare the hiding of funds a threat to national security and require that anyone with offshore assets disclose them to the IRS within 30 days and pay taxes, interest, and penalties within 180 days. For the holdouts, temporary special teams in the IRS and Justice Department could speedily pursue civil or criminal charges. Now, I really think that that's the sort of thing we're going to be seeing under the Obama administration. I think it's driven by the logic of their economic program and perspective. They're talking basically about policies that are going to destroy what remains of the value of the dollar. When that happens, people are going to want to flee the American economy, including Americans. Some Americans are going to want to leave. I'm committed to staying here. I'm not going to let them have my country without a fight. But there are other people who, according to the wisdom they've been given, will want to leave with what they've earned. And they're going to find that these restrictions on travel that have been introduced supposedly to protect us from terrorism are now going to be converted into means of restricting our freedom of movement and the freedom of movement of our capital out of the sense of the national security interest that our government would have in controlling all of the wealth as our country becomes a larger and less colorful version of Zimbabwe. So I really can see how this would happen. It wouldn't happen maybe as dramatically as Mr. Johnson is saying, but I believe that this is the direction that Obama is going to go, and a lot of these counterterrorism measures, a lot of these enhanced powers that have been used by the Bush administration purportedly to fight the war on terror are going to be used to fight the war to reconstruct the American economy. And I think that's probably going to be his larger set of priorities right now. And in this connection, I just have to point out that it is indigestibly ironic to see that Mr. Geithner, I believe that's how his name is supposed to be pronounced, isn't it? Is it Geithner or Geithner?
I think it's Geithner.
Geithner. That Mr. Geithner just forgot to pay his taxes. I mean, here's a guy who is with the Federal Reserve in New York who goes before Congress and chastises China from manipulating its currency. This guy's with the Federal Reserve System. That's all they do is manipulate the currency. It's a fiat currency, for heaven's sake.
I really think that he feels he's among the elite, and he doesn't really have to. He blamed this on the software that he used on his computer. It was the software that was really responsible.
It didn't
ask him about that money, and there's no question he knew he was supposed to pay it. He was actually given that money by the IMF so he could pay the taxes on it. And he didn't do it. He knew what he was doing. He just apologized so profusely. This will be the most powerful man financially in the United States.
Yes,
you know,
he will be
in charge of the Internal Revenue Service. And, I'm sure he won't punish anybody else, you know. He was able to get by with just paying, the tax and the interest, but, no punishment for the fact that he intentionally didn't pay his taxes, but it was all the fault of the software.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I know of people who've been literally driven into penury because of completely in his mistakes that they have made. And this guy is going to be the economic dictator. He's taking over for Herr Paulson. His powers will be plenary, plenipotentiary. They will be unqualified, unchallengeable, unreviewable. He's somebody, obviously, who has had a very large role in creating the problem, as did Mr. Paulson. I don't know that you could really distinguish between the two of them as to which is more liable in terms of responsibility for this situation. I mean, Mr. Geithner was with the Federal Reserve System. Mr. Paulson spent a lot of time building a lot of the derivatives that are now exploding. It's too close to call as to which of those two dictators is more responsible for our problem.
Hold a little. Be back in just a moment. Well, William, we got so interested in what you had to say, we didn't get your webpage out there to tell people how they get in touch with you. So why don't you go ahead and get that information out now?
All right. The easiest way to get a hold of what I write, to have access to my writings, is to go to willgrigg.com. And we're still trying to trick out and flesh out that website. It's something of a shell website right now. But if you go to willgrigg.com, look at the upper right-hand corner of the page. There's a set of exterior links. And the top of that list of external links is a link to my daily blog, Pro Libertate. It's not a daily blog. It's a 3 to 5 times weekly blog, depending upon my schedule. Depending upon the vagaries of my schedule, I'll publish between 3 and 5 essays a week. They're usually between 1,800 and 3,000 words. Every once in a while, I will become self-indulgent, write something 4,000 or 5,000 words long, but very rarely. Most of the time, they're of a more reader-friendly length than that. This is not a blog in the conventional sense. It's not simply random, brief summaries of things that I find interesting or brief write-ups and links to articles of interest. I really should have a blog of that sort, but I don't have time for that type of an undertaking. What I do is I write opinion pieces that hopefully will have some element of investigative journalism about them, try to get below the surface of the story, show the plate tectonics of what's going on with respect to the thing that obsesses me the most of all political elements and all concerns of a terrestrial nature, and that is individual human freedom. It's written from a Christian libertarian point of view. And if you go to willgrigg.com, go to Pro Libertate, at the bottom of every essay there's a link to Amazon.com where you can order my most recent book, Liberty and Eclipse, The War on Terror and the Rise of the Homeland Security State. We've almost sold out the first edition. There will be a second edition, probably an expanded and enhanced one to talk about the Obama administration, some of the changes that are happening. But you can order, those of you in the listening audience who are interested, can order that book through my blog, Pro Libertate. Go to willgrigg.com, find the link to Pro Libertate, and then go to the bottom of the essay. I'd appreciate it if you read the essay to get to the bottom of it. And you can order it there.
All right. Well, thank you so very much. And we certainly appreciate having you with us. And, Chris, we'll look forward to talking to you again, Chris, next week. I think that we're on the verge of some very momentous things happening. I'm not sure exactly what they are. I'm sure that they will involve, of course, the progressive destruction of the economy of our nation, because this is the crux of everything going on today. And, Chris, what really frightens me is that so many people have no idea what's coming down the line, and they will not understand until the product of their entire life has been destroyed. Well, we'll talk to you next week again, William. Thank you so very much for being with us. Good night. God bless.
God bless.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan. We do hope, of course, that you've enjoyed our conversation with William Greig. And we are in difficult times. If you've not yet heard my talk on the financial tsunami, we gave it probably 3 years or so ago. You need to have that and the syllabus. You need to listen to it several times. You need to read my little pamphlet on the history of money, what you should know, inexpensive, and then, of course, the financial meltdown. This is two pamphlets we offer, simply compilations of our newsletters. You can go up on the Internet, pull down the newsletters, or get them in pamphlet form, which is just convenient to have for references. And I will have to admit that I like to pull them out and look at the things we've talked about before and written about before and refresh my memory, and I think that you'll enjoy them. Then let me point out that we carry, of course, three books. One is entitled The Creature from Jekyll Island. One is entitled The Federal Reserve Conspiracy. It was written by Professor Sutton. And then the third is Fiat Money Inflation in France. You need to have this information. Now, let me suggest my November 2008 newsletter, and it's called The Financial Elite Part 1. You find it at RadioLiberty.com. If you get any of your other items, we'll be glad to send you a copy of that. And then, of course, to really put things into perspective, you need to get the little pamphlets put out by the Lucius Trust. It used to be the Lucifer Publishing House. It was channeled to Alice Bailey in the first half of the last century by a demonic spirit that she called Joa Cool. It's called The Working of the Spiritual Hierarchy, and it simply talks about how they have their people planted in key positions, certainly in finance, in commerce, in industry, in education, in the religions, but they have their people financed in the financial markets all throughout the world. So you need to get that little pamphlet, and then, of course, you need to read Henry Kissinger's recent article that was published on the 12th of January. That's the 12th of January in the International Herald Tribune. And it's entitled The Coming of the New World Order, something of that effect. It's all about the new international order. You can Google it in by Googling Henry Kissinger, International Herald Tribune, a new international order, or just international order. You need to read it and understand Henry Kissinger lays it all out. The world either will go along and create this new international order, or there will be chaos and fragmentation and the total destruction of the world as we know it economically. You need to read this article. You need to understand the goal of the ancient mystery religions has always been a world government. The goal of the Trilateral Commission, which Henry Kissinger belongs to, has been a world government. The goal of the Council on Foreign Relations, the Bilderbergers, that Henry Kissinger belongs to, is a world government. And it would seem that these goal of the ancient mystery religions is being, of course, carried out today by the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations, and the Bilderbergers. And perhaps that is why George Bush, in his second inaugural address, talked about, you know, when our founding fathers declared a new order of the ages, they were acting on an ancient hope that is meant to be fulfilled. Now, that's the essence of what he said. He threw a lot of things in the middle there to confuse you, but the essence of what he said was when our founders declared a new order of the ages, they were acting on an ancient hope that is meant to be fulfilled. What is the new order of the ages? It's the Novo Ordo Seclorum, which is written beneath the pyramid on the back of the dollar bill. And above the pyramid hovers the all-seeing eye in a triangle, a glorified eye, which is the emblem of the ancient mystery religions. None of these things are happening by accident. They're happening by intent. Our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We hope many of you will want to join the Radio Liberty family and help us as we continue reaching out across America to a growing audience. More and more people are looking for answers, and we have them. And then, of course, we hope you'll go to our website, RadioLiberty.com, that you'll pray for America, that you'll pray for revival, but that you'll pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and for our protection, and for a great revival in America.